You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Due to technical difficulties, part of this talk is missing.
So, let me introduce you to the interesting people. Here are Kate Massey. Kate is a Church of England priest and she's a member of General Synod. And you're the convener of Inclusive Evangelicals. One of them. One of them, OK. Hayley Young is a Baptist minister. 3 years ago, she was the president of the Baptist Union. And she...
Oh, my word. Oh, no. I was trying to stop the whistle on it, but we will manage, don't you worry. I'm very close to the speakers, so I think that would be why it is. You chose, didn't you, as your theme for your year. Tell us what theme you chose.
So my theme for the year was building a bigger table, challenging us to listen to each other.
Brilliant. Claire Davison comes from Peterborough, where she's a United Reformed Church minister. And Claire, will you please thank the URC for us for hosting us today? Steve Chalk is also a Baptist minister. He's the founder and CEO of the Oasis Trust. That's the Christian charity, not the band. And is, but it's never too late, Steve. And is a professional good egg. So we're delighted to have you with us this morning. I'm going to set the questions going, and then we will hand over to questions from the... from the people who are sheltering from the rain later on. Can I just, first of all, start on a really positive note? Could I ask each of you to say where you've seen a good example of Christians disagreeing well? Who would like to take that one first? Claire, would you like to?
Okay. Is it near enough yet? Got it,
Okay. And that to me was a very hard question to answer because when I was thinking about it before this, I was thinking, actually, there's so many examples of Christians not agreeing well. But I think with just the United Reformed Church as a denomination, so we came together with the Congregational Union and the Presbyterian Church, and then the Churches of Christ joined us later. And actually, that is how we agree well, because there was so much within that that we had to talk through. I wasn't part of it at the time, I was too young, but there was a lot to talk through. And I think that's ongoing. The church, Congregational Church of Scotland joined in 2000 as well. So there's been a lot of talking, a lot of having to agree well. And as a denomination, I think we're quite good at that.
Brilliant, thank you very much. That's a great example of a structural way in which churches have come to disagree well. I wonder if there are personal ways in local churches where you've seen examples like that. Would anyone like to pick that one up? Steve?
Well, I don't know.
So, for those of you that are aware, the Baptist Union have just gone through a whole discussion about what inclusion looks like for them. And there have been some churches that have genuinely wrestled with what it means to love all and welcome all. And I've seen several churches that, through those painful conversations, have reached a point where they've gone, okay, we know that we can't all agree on this, but what we are going to say is we're not going to withhold anyone from becoming a leader. We've listened so much to the stories and we recognise Christ in each other enough that we're going to say we won't all hold the same view as each other, but we're not going to withhold leadership because of certain choices or who people are, which I think is absolutely amazing and a brilliant witness to this world.
You want to pick that up, Steve?
Yeah, well, just following on from that, that's great because I don't know how long ago it was, a decade and a bit ago, I wrote and said that once it was legal to officiate at same-sex marriages, once same-sex marriages were a legal thing, I would do it, and I set out theologically why I believe that was a really important thing to do. And following on from that, I was visited by the chair of the Baptist Union, my local regional minister, all separately, and the head of ministry for the Baptist denomination, all three of them came to see me separately, and all three of them told me that unless I changed my mind, I would be thrown out of the Baptist Union and cease to be a Baptist minister. So that was back in, 2010 or 11 or something. So isn't that an extraordinary journey to reach that different point? I never did get chucked out, by the way, so that was great.
Steve, how did you deal with all the nasty things that were thrown at you at that time because of the stance you took?
Then and now. Every single day. I've not looked at my social media today, mostly because there's not much signal here. But every single day I'm told that I'm going to hell, I'm going to, it's not a job, I don't believe in it, really. So, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there is a type of theology, I don't know what one else would say, that has to be right. And therefore, anybody who disagrees with them is in trouble. So, you know, one attitude would be to write back to people that tell me that I'm the son of Satan, I'm the beast, I'm the Antichrist, which is really big boots to fill, isn't it? The Antichrist. is to write back and go, no, I'm not, you are. But actually, that the theology, the understanding of Jesus that I have slowly grasped, am slowly grasping, means that I just don't want to fight back, you know. So when I got the time, when people curse me, what I always write back is I send them a smiley and say, God bless you. You know, and that's how you cope with it. Well, that's how I cope with it. I believe that the gospel is bigger than me and my church and my view.
Brilliant. Thank you. Kate.
To do a little bit of the structural stuff again, one of the places that, again, I see difference sometimes lived with well is in the Church of England. Now, that's not me being a kind of smug Church of England person. As you can probably tell, I didn't start out there. I started out in Scotland. I love Scotland. Go there on holiday every year. Weather's usually like this. Go to the northwest of Scotland, you'll find there's little communities, remote rural communities, 300 people, 4 churches. Scots are brilliant at schism. Honestly, it's one, you know. If there was an Olympics in it, we'd top the league. And we're also, certainly the cultural background I grew up in was quite sectarian. And that didn't really affect my life much until I married a Roman Catholic. And then things got interesting. Our families were great. Everybody else was a bit, ooh. And the trouble was, well, which church did we go to? Whichever one we went to, one of us was going to be dodgy. And neither of us wanted to relinquish our spiritual heritage, our denominational heritage. Fortunately, 3 months later, my husband got a job in England and we pitched up at the Church of England where, do you know, well, perhaps everybody's dodgy. Maybe that's the way of thinking about it. And we both found a home. And generally, the Church of England has been reasonably good at holding together quite a wide breadth of people. And it's something I really value about it. At its absolute best, Anglicanism has a charism of theological modesty, which is we don't know everything and we have things to learn from each other. And that's a bit, I think, what Steve is talking about in terms of, you know, God is bigger. God is bigger than just one expression of the church. But obviously the Church of England doesn't agree on many, many things, and we're doing a really good job of showing that to the world at the moment. But go back 10 years ago, one of the things we really didn't agree on was women in ministry. Could women be bishops? And we decided eventually, yes, they could. But there was quite a lot of compromise happened. And 10 years on, we're looking at that compromise and we realise it's had a bigger impact on women in ministry than we realised. And so now I'm part of a group where I sit around a table with a bunch of very well-meaning people who generally think I shouldn't exist. And we talk about how the Church of England can do difference well. And we have some pretty challenging conversations. But actually, some of my strongest advocates to support women in ministry are people who are in other groups who recognise that somebody has made space for them, so they need to be part of making space for me.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. This is such a positive start to the discussion, but I'm slightly regretting. I'm going to put a challenge in now. Is there a red line that we can't cross? If you're in a church where you're trying to reconcile yourself to people who have disagreements with you, is there a point where you have to say, I can't take this anymore, I'm going to have to move on somewhere else because they will never change? Who'd like to pick that one up?
If I begin, I had a friend who I talked to here some years ago, and she worked for a Baptist theological college. She came and sat down with me on a sunny day out here and said, I'm gay. I can't tell anybody in my college that I am gay. I know if I do, I'll lose my place. I'm dependent on the income from my job as one of the tutors for my family. What do I do? We sat and talked, and then she said to me, she said, Steve, the thing about you is you stand up for what you believe, and you stood up to the Baptist Union and they threatened to throw you out, but you didn't back down. And that makes me feel that I should behave in the same way. And I simply said to her, well, you know, we're all in different positions in life. We're all in different positions in life. I was very fortunate because though I was a Baptist minister in the 80s, I set up the Oasis Trust. And the Oasis Trust is now a huge organisation which in some sense shelters me. Does that make sense? Mm. So, to be honest, if I had got chucked out of the Baptist Union, it wouldn't have made a lot of difference in one way. Does that make sense? But for her to speak up would have been really difficult. And I think that there's not one size that fits all. Some people are called because they feel it in them to stand up and make a noise. And we need people like that. And we need people who say, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to go and do something new. We're going to create a new expression. But other people, I think, for them, it's working quietly way inside the system. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. But the answer to your question isn't binary. That's what I'd say. I don't know what others might say about it. I know people who've left the synod, I'm sure you do, because they just can't stick it. I'm thinking of Jane O'Zan, for instance. So Jane takes a particular view, and you've taken a different approach, haven't you?
I think there's something about passing on a baton. I think everybody, I mean, lots of people come to Greenbelt because they're activists. And lots of you will know about activist fatigue. You've got to give it your best shot. And then sometimes it's okay to take a step back, look after yourself and pass the baton on to somebody else. There's been people in General Synod, people in the Church of England working for LGBTQIA inclusion for over 30 years. And they still love Jesus and they still love the church at the end of it. And how that is possible can only be the grace of God. But some of them have stepped back and said, right, come on, your turn. And it's my privilege to be part of an incredible group that are continuing that work as best we can. In terms of, is there a red line? I don't know. I think, again, I totally agree with Steve. It's very individual where people's red lines will be. And I think people's safety has to be really important, where they feel safe and where they can be the person God made them to be. In terms of kind of structural stuff, I try to hold people to account. So again, I'm boringly heteronormative. I've got my ally Tia shirt on because that's the best I can be. So again, a lot of my experience I talk from is more to do with women in ministry because that's where I've got more lived experience. And so what I really try to do is hold people to account that they might have theological differences, but if it slips over into misogyny, I'm going to call it out and I'm going to expect other people to call it out too. So I think we have to be really good at holding ourselves accountable, that theological difference, let's have a conversation. But if it turns into prejudices, unexamined prejudices, then I want to be having, you know, holding people to account for that.
Brilliant. Thank you. there are lots of people in the tent today who are activists. There are also a lot of people here who are just ordinary and just in churches. I wonder, Claire or Hayley, would you like to pick it up on behalf of people who are just sitting in a church, ordinary? How do we help them this morning?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because there are people for whom a disagreement within the church will mean that they leave. As a local church minister, I feel that my approach is to try and talk with them and work with them and work with the church as well. And I'm thinking of an instance actually in a church that I'm taking over next year, where somebody has left, but she caused so many problems to people, including accusing people of different things, that actually that red line had to be in place. She had to go. And so there are instances where that is the case. But for me as well, I think we need to respect each other as much as we can. And that's my focus when there are disagreements in church, that we need to respect what each other believe and who we are.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question, but I don't want to, you know, can I ask you a question after this? Well, do you find, you know, you've already been described, Peter, as very old. Do you find it gets easier the older you are? So my latest battle that I'm squaring up for, and have done quite a lot of work in the last 4 or 5 days, perhaps a week over, is I'm squaring up for a battle with two government departments, and I decided I'm going to get the law changed. I've decided I've got a strategy in place right now, and talk to various people about it. But then I think is it true that the older you get, the easier this is? Because basically, you know how old I am. I'm 68, so I don't care. You reach the place where what's the point in playing this game? Because there's no hill to climb. Does that make any sense to you as another old man?
The truth is, Steve, it hurts just as much. I've just been in a position over the last year when I've been asked to, as a lay leader of a church, which I've been asked to leave because I'm gay and I've had to make a home in a new church. The bishop stepped in and was wonderful and rescued me, and she said, this is where you need to be, you will heal here. And it has been wonderful, there are good things out of it. But although the sort of battle gets easier because you've been through it, the hurt doesn't get any easier. Can I pass over to Hayley?
Yeah, I was going to say, our red lines are probably dependent on our places of privilege. So as older white men, of which I'm not, there is a certain privilege and a space where you can use your voice. So the red line might be different for you because the cost is different. Likelihood is, if you've been, especially if you're a minister, if you've been ministering for 20 years, there's a freedom, there's a privilege that brings. If you're starting out in your ministry, it's really hard to speak out against these things because your card is marked and people have certain perceptions about you. I guess in terms of local church life, there are times where, for me, unity is the red line, and I can only speak as a female minister and the misogyny into that context. And it's, for me, it's where it crosses the boundary where you jeopardise our unity in Christ and become abusive, then that can be a red line. And I know, speaking as a cis straight female, it's easy for me to say, can you stay in that space and count the cost? Because that's ultimately what we're asking people to do. So my challenge to people is always, actually, if you feel that red line is there, and in order for you to heal and be productive, you need to be in a different space, that's fine. But if we just all exodus out, which the conversations around the Baptist Union have been at this time, then others will fill that space, and they're not necessarily people that will be fruitful in that space.
Hayley, that's a fantastic answer. Yeah, thank you. As the subject has come up, let's continue on this line for a minute. There are lots of people in this tent will be LGBT plus or will be LGBT plus allies. What can those two groups do in their own churches to make life more like the life that Jesus had in mind for them? Who'd like to pick that one up? Kate, inclusive evangelicals have made this quite an issue. Would you like to? If you're struggling, somebody here will rescue you.
Yeah, give me a minute to think.
So the question is, what as an ally and what as a member of the community you can do in your church? And I just want to say, shine. That's what you can do. Being you is enough. It doesn't feel like it at times. It can be really difficult and challenging, but actually that path of just trying to see Jesus in another and reflecting Jesus is enough witness. And even if it's not enough witness for those in the church, it certainly is for those in the world. And actually in a divided world, we need to be the ones saying, actually, we're better than this and we won't tolerate, we will call out the bad behaviour. And allies, we really do need to start calling out the bad behaviour and counting that cost. But you being you, representing Jesus, is enough, is what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see Steve bursting to get in.
Go for it, I'm still percolating.
So I would simply say, we have to change the congregation. So Oasis Churches, there are several Oasis Churches now. And one of the issues we now have is churches wanting to join Oasis. And they come to us because they decided they want to. If you think of theology as a giant brick wall, and there's a brick in the wall called LGBT exclusion, and they want to get rid of that, and they want to stuff in a brick that says LGBT inclusion. And what we say to them all is, actually, what you've got to do is take the whole wall down, not just replace a brick, because it will not work to keep your old theology and just say we're friendly to gay people. Now, the truth is about Oasis churches is they've grown up that way. So my wife, who's in the tent here, Cornelia, she's a refugee, came to this country and lived up the road from me as a refugee. I grew up in South London. As the son of, my nickname when I was a kid was half caste. You know, I'm Indian English. It's not that I've been on holiday and got a suntan. I came out this way. You know, it's kind of like. And there's another thing, isn't it? People assume all sorts of things. So I think that because of our upbringing, and because of the struggles we face as children in terms of poverty and not belonging and not quite belonging anywhere, it perhaps that's what gave a bigger view. So for me, inclusion is LGBT inclusion, because that is a symptom or an outcome of a different theology, a bigger way of seeing the world. Later today, somewhere, I'm speaking with somebody who works for Oasis, Julie Siddiqui. Julie is a Muslim. And she's an Oasis community builder. We're a Christ-centered organisation. And Julie is part of Oasis because she loves the Christ-centeredness, which is utterly inclusive of everyone. So inclusion is never about, I've warned something. If inclusion becomes about the inclusion of gay people or trans people, actually, that's a pretty sorry place. Inclusion has to be big and bold. And then everyone gets in.
So, answering questions, I always end up answering two. So the first thing to say is that, yes, absolutely right. Is my microphone on? Hello. Oh, there we go. Right. So firstly, I absolutely agree with Steve, and I'm going to disagree with him. Because if you go onto the Inclusive Evangelicals podcast, or if you've watched Songs of Praise recently, you might have seen an amazing guy called Nick Bundock. Now, Nick is one of our conveners, and 10 years ago, very very tragically, a child in their community died because they thought that their faith was not compatible with their sexuality. And basically, the moment that happened, Nick committed himself, his leaders and his church to a journey of change. And they started out by wanting to be the most inclusive, loving, supportive place they could be for people, whatever their sexuality. And they found that as they did that, they became inclusive in all sorts of other ways. People started rocking up who'd been othered by the church for other reasons because there was a place that they felt safe. So Nick tells the story so much better. Inclusive Evangelicals podcast, go take a look. I think the reason I was finding it difficult to answer the question is that as a, you know, as a straight leader, white leader, I don't really feel in a place to be qualified to say, well, what will make the church better for my LGBTQIA friends? I suppose what we're trying to do in Inclusive Evangelicals is let the conversation happen. And we're encouraging people, whatever churches they happen to be in, to have confidence in the theology that they hold, that God is this incredibly inclusive, loving God, and to have those conversations and to help people to think differently and to begin that journey of change. Many of us in the evangelical world grew up in churches which were not inclusive, and we've been on a bit of a journey, helped by people like Steve and other brave people who've spoken out. And we need to be that for the next person. So we're trying to create a space where we can have the conversations, have the questions, have the confidence, have the encouragement, have the prayer support to be those people for somebody else.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to pick up on what Hayley said about unity, because I think that is so important. It's so easy if you're including one group of people to actually be excluding another group. In the local church, certainly in the local church setting, and to focus on unity, what we have together, and seeing Christ in each other, I think is the most important thing, so that we can, yeah, be one together. And it's that witness as well, isn't it? The witness to Christ, to the world. In John 17, Jesus said that he wanted us all to be one, so that the world would believe. And I think that's form of unity is what we need to be holding. True.
Thank you. We're half an hour in, so I want to be a bit provocative. There are also people in our churches who are conservative on all these issues, not because they're nasty people, but because they've got deeply held values that make them think that is what God wants. And they are uncomfortable because their leaders are encouraging an inclusive attitude to LGBT people. If we're going to be the sort of big, big inclusion that you're talking about, Steve, how do we help them in their churches? Steve?
Well, I think there's often, on all sorts of issues, a huge gap between the latest understanding of the biblical text, the books that make up the library we call the Bible, and what gets taught out in churches. I remember some years ago going to a meeting of evangelical charismatic leaders across the board, you know, denominations, new denominations, etc. And what became really obvious in that private meeting, it was called, you know, Chatham House Rules and all the rest of it, is almost everybody in the room had a different private view to their public view. So when I say we need to follow the latest theology, it's like following the latest science. You know, we are constantly excavating. Archaeologists are digging up, you know, new documents. We are constantly able to interpret and translate the ancient Greek or the Hebrew of the Bible better than we used to do. If you look at a Bible, when I was ordained, I was given an NIV Bible, you know, New International Version of the Bible. If I pick up an NIV Bible today, it says different things. You don't notice it because you just think it's an NIV Bible. But if this seminar was about something else, I could tell you about enormous changes that blow theology apart and rebuild it that have been made over the years. Why? Because the archaeologists and the anthropologists and the translators have come to a better understanding of the context. A text without a context is always a pretext. So we have to do that work. But the result of that is that people who do that work end up with a better understanding than the people in the churches. So to sum this all up in one thing, I'm so used to this happening to me, but I can tell it I'm picturing a particular time. So I went along to this church to talk about LGBT inclusion. Okay? I was asked to. In fact, they did a whole day on it, and I was the keynote speaker or whatever. And the vicar and the curate said to me, they said it before I arrived, but when I arrived, they said, Steve, it's fantastic you're here to do this because you can say things to these people that we can't possibly say. It's impossible. So I do all this stuff. On the way out, at the end of the day, people are coming up to me in their droves saying, oh, Steve, that was fantastic. I mean, you speak with so much clarity, but it's so hard here because our vicar and the curate just don't get it. When they'd all gone, the vicar and the curate say, it was a vicar and the curate. He said to me, oh, Steve, that was brilliant. I hope people listen because it's so hard here. Everyone's scared of someone else. The vicar and the curate are scared of losing not just their job, but their home and their security for their children, etc., etc. They're scared of losing friendships. The congregation are scared that if they speak up for what they think, they're going to be ridiculed and somebody's going to say to them, you really don't understand the Bible in that, and you never, what about Romans chapter 1 and all this kind of stuff? So there's this conspiracy of silence where everyone's scared of someone else. And that's often why things don't move forward, in my view. I don't know what you guys think.
Steve, that is brilliant and hilarious. Would you like to pick up the subject there?
I can't actually remember the question.
How are we going to help people who are deeply conservative?
Okay.
In a church where the leadership doesn't share that.
Okay, dang. I have to say I'm part of GEAR, which is a group for evangelism and renewal within the United Reformed Church. And so we are kind of fairly broad evangelicals now, more of the inclusive sort, but there are still conservative evangelicals in our ranks, and rightly so if we're a broad church, because we should be accepting everyone. I think it's what we've come to do within the URC, rather than try and batter the conservative evangelicals, trying to batter their views out, is actually come to prayer. And so we pray for URC every week. We've got a podcast, a video podcast, whatever you call it, goes out every week praying for the denomination. And I think that's part of it, is that if we're praying for each other, then we're recognising Christ in each other.
Thank you for bringing us back to the heart of the matter. Thank you. Kate, would you like to pick us up?
Again, I'm kind of feeling a bit challenged because I am that leader, and our church recently had the conversations about using prayers of love and faith and agreed that's what we're going to do. And we had a couple of people who left our church, and that was sad and hard. But we sent them on their way with our blessing and our love, because we want them to be in a church where they feel they can thrive, and they felt that couldn't be with us anymore. That's not to say that the remaining congregation are all exactly where I am, but actually we've dealt with quite a lot of difference as a church over the last however many years. So COVID, we all had different ideas about what safe church during COVID looked like, and there's had to be quite a lot of careful conversation about that. Brexit, I was telling Peter, I'm like, rabidly remain, and my parish voted 70% leave. That was a fun morning to wake up to. And I knew that at least half my congregation had voted leave, and we had to, and there was really high emotions then. But we've always just held a line that, we love God, we love one another, we love our community. And I think it's what Hayley was saying earlier about if we can see Christ in one another, we can continue to work together for the kingdom of God. So I think there's probably people who disagree with me and are just like, okay, yeah, we'll humour Kate kind of thing. But we put that primacy of loving God, loving one another, and loving our community first.
Brilliant. I'm going to come back to that. Oh, of course. I'm going to come back to a more political issue in just a moment. But Hayley, can I bring you in on that subject of how do we help people who are deeply conservative?
Yeah, and coming from a broadly conservative movement within the Baptist Union, I think we need to understand the context. Sometimes it's really easy to demonise people, isn't it? It's really easy to go, oh, there's conservatives over there. And I do it all the time as a fervent Remainer. I've really struggled not to use the pulpit wrongly that following Sunday. I think there is an element where we have to understand that for some, for many, church represents a stability in their life. When everything else feels out of control, it's the one thing where they can control. It's the one thing where they know what to expect. And we as church leaders have to lament that we've done a really bad job because we've just preached and gone, you believe that, and not given people the tools to own their faith. So we need to lament on that and change the way we do things. But I think what we don't always do is the conversation is go, actually, all this is happening in society out there. People feel like their values are being overturned by this woke narrative. And actually they come to a church and then they go, now this is being changed here as well. And they feel like they can't express themselves because if they express themselves, then they're going to be judged. Sometimes it's right to challenge it. I'm not excusing anything. I'm trying to understand the context in which people bring this to church. And when you say to people, actually, but maybe God doesn't see it like that. Maybe God is big enough for this difference. They just can't handle it because they've not been equipped long enough. So we have to do the harder work of journeying with people and knowing that their voice is just as valid at the table as long as they present it in a respectful way. That actually we're not about changing each other's minds. We're not about forcing opinion on each other. We're about saying, actually, we can hold this difference and walk with each other. And I think the fear narrative comes in. So the loud voice is going, but if you believe this, if you change your view on that, if you don't remain conservative on this issue, then actually the church is going to die, this is going to happen, there's going to be absolute outrage in the sanctuary. It's just fear. It's just lies. So the normative people have to call that out while saying actually there is space and time for everyone here.
Brilliant. Thank you. Yeah.
And I was just going to kind of circle back to something you said earlier about in a polarised society, being able to see we have our differences, but we still love one another is quite a prophetic act. And I think that's so when people are in a place of fear, giving them a positive vision of we are divided and yet we can still care for one another. And that's a prophetic and hopeful position rather than a fear-based one.
Yeah, could I say two things very briefly? Picking up on what Peter, you just said, I think that is the job of theologians, church leaders, to do theology, because I'm always going to believe what I always believed unless you give me the way of articulating something different. And I've discovered over the years, as I've sat with people who were adamantly against any gay person being even part of a church, you know, particularly being involved in any leadership or working with children, all of those things. But then you give them a theological language, an understanding. You allow them to articulate the thought they've always had. And a number of people I've had conversations with who actually said to me, Steve, well, actually, I always believed this. I just didn't know you could say it. And I didn't know how to say it. So I think that's important. And the other thing I'd say, I don't know how many of you have looked at what's called spiral dynamics. Do you know about spiral dynamics? Well, one of the great insights of spiral dynamics, you really should study, it's a fantastic thing. There's loads on the internet about spiral dynamics. It's about psychological development of any human being. And the truth is, there's a stage in life, which I think in spiral dynamics is called the blue stage. And the blue stage of life is, I'm right and I know everything. And then you get a bit beyond the blue stage and you realise there's a load of stuff you don't know.
and you become more liberal, more inclusive. I don't mean liberal as in flaky, I mean liberal as in open and embracing. And you become like that, but the danger at that next stage up is to look down on the blue people and go, I used to be blue, but now I know everything. And that, but the stage of beyond that is when I realise that, in fact, as open as I might think of myself in some regards, I'm still pretty blue in other regards, and we're all on a journey always. So it's not that we've reached some higher plane, it's that we're all journeying together. And in some places we're open, and in some places we're all still pretty closed, don't we? We don't even know what they are. That's the problem.
I'm going to pick up another kind of difference in our churches. For years, we were aware of political differences in our churches, and we got by never talking about it. We just said, oh, that's Monday to Saturday stuff. On Sunday, we have no political opinions at all. But I think that's becoming increasingly difficult because our politics is becoming more polarised. And Christian nationalism is on the rise and making itself known. How can we dream a church where people, even on the more extremes of our politics, can say, well, there is a place for me at this table as well? How can people from the whole range of political opinions find church to be a place of life and hope? Who would like to pick that one? Nobody.
Well, I've always got.
Do you know, my fallback position this morning was, if ever there's a silence, look at Steve and see if the microphone's near his mouth. Oh, it is.
So as it happens, Paulina, my wife and I, one England very recently, went out with some really good friends of ours who are more right-wing than you can possibly imagine, immigration, all the rest of it. But we love them, we love them. And what binds us together and has bound us together, I've known them as a couple since I was 14, and they have completely different political views to me on almost every count, but completely political different views to me on almost every count. But I love them, they're my friends, and I care for them. But what makes it all work is this, and I think this on a wider thing. I often think of Oasis, this organisation I'm part of now, as we're not a think tank, we're a doom tank. We do stuff, and as you do it, you think about it. We set up things, we run giant projects. And these particular friends of mine, they run this fantastic project within Oasis, a fantastic project. And it's doing stuff, it's getting your hands dirty, it's meeting needs, it's creating inclusion that changes everything. So I think that in my experience, you hold people together when you stop talking about it and you start doing something about shared needs. And it's amazing the difference it makes.
Thank you, Steve. Anybody else like to pick that one up?
I agree about the doing stuff. When I first moved from one church to another and I had to do my profile, I put that I was a radical evangelical, by which I meant going and doing as Jesus did, which was very political if we read the Gospels, what I think it is. Other people might not agree. And I think, yeah, we need to be doing, and it doesn't matter what political stream we're on. If we're working together in that way, yeah.
I also think it's about maturity, isn't it, right? So I don't hang out with people just so that they can echo my view and tell me how great I am, although that's wonderful if anyone wants to do that. I think I intentionally have friendships and hang with people, and I'm with people in church because I want to grow and I want to learn. Now, don't get me wrong, I struggle sometimes to see where I can grow and learn from people on the far right of where we find ourselves. But I have to recognise there is something of God within them that I can learn from, that I can see. So I think the place of churches within this political divide is actually, how can we genuinely learn and hear from each other? Because I think pastorally what I've seen is most people want to know and hear that they are seen and valued. And once people are seen and valued, we can understand even in our differences.
I feel bad if I don't answer it. I mean, I obviously, as we've heard already, live in a parish where my views and the views of some of my congregation are very, very different. People occasionally say I shouldn't be political and I tell them to go and read their Bible again. But what I make a real point of as a church leader is I say I'm political, but I'm not party political. I'll be equally, you know, it's equal opportunity. I'll critique you if I don't like your policies. And what I try to encourage people to do is whichever their political stance is to ask them, how does that allow you to love your neighbour? That's the question to take to whatever, you know, to take into the polling booth. How is my vote going to help me love my neighbour? And that's just what I leave them with.
Thank you. We've got about 5 or 10 minutes left, and I wonder if there are questions from the floor. I don't know how this is going to work, because I can't take this microphone out to you, and we've got rain on the roof. So you're just going to have to be dramatic and shout. Can I invite a question from the back? Sir? We've heard the term being fruitful, which came up in the conversation.
For each of us in our individual context, how could we work through that so that we could see growth amongst the division that we have to live?
For each of us in our own context, how can we use that to promote growth amongst the people with whom we live and agree and disagree with? Thank you. Good question. Anybody like to pick that up?
I think when I think of fruitful, I always think of the fruits of the Spirit. I came from churches where we talked a lot about gifts of the Spirit, but fruits of the Spirit are much more what I think we should be cultivating. Because as Paul says, you know, who can complain about those things? They are things that enable relationship, enable safety, enable love. So I'm not going to try and remember them all. It's a bit like the Seven Dwarfs. I always forget one. But, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, something, something, self-control. Oh, this is where the real evangelicals are turning up. Well done. So I think that's a good place to start. And the thing about the fruits of the Spirit is that we grow them in partnership with God, that it's not something we necessarily have to do ourselves, but something we pray for and can receive as gift to, often without realising it.
The only thing I would say is, you know, the evangelicalism I grew up in said, what are you going to do for God's kingdom? If you die tonight, why should God let you into his heaven? What
cheery.
You? You know, get busy, Jesus is coming. You know, so you think, it was all about me. And, of course, the New Testament is all about us, really. Our poverty in the English language is that you is singular and you is pure plural. And I'm sure you all know, as good evangelicals, that when the Bible talks about you, it's talking about us. So I think that when the preacher says, what are you going to do to build God's kingdom? There is a sense in which that's true. But it's about us. You don't want a church with, you know, 100 people in and 100 people doing different things. You've got to coalesce around something and make that thing develop. So it's about working together and bringing your skills. And when we do that together, my experience is you can be fruitful. Oasis became responsible for a United Reformed Church and a Baptist Church. One church, you know, it's in London. We call it Oasis Church Waterloo. And it had about 10 people in. You know, I became the minister in 2003, September the 4th or something like that. And it did nothing, you know, except turn up at 5 to 11 and empty out at 5 past 12. Yeah, that was it. But there was hidden talent in all of those people, but they never saw their skills. Now, today, that church, the church thrives. We run a community centre where I was yesterday morning meeting one of the teaching union leaders who'd come along to see what we were doing. We run a primary school, a children's
centre, a secondary school, etc., 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 etc. And it's all because a group of people learn to actually work together and bring their different skills, and the whole thing grows. Together is the way.
Yeah, I agree. And being fruitful, that's kind of an example of being fruitful, isn't it? And the church that I'm in Peterborough at the moment have just done a community audit looking at how we can serve the local community in a different way. Over 20 years ago, they did a community audit and discovered that there was a lot of older, lonely people. So they started a weekly organisation with Age UK, actually. But it was kind of that focus on doing something together. And now they're thinking again, what are we going to do? What should we focus on? And I think that's a way a local church can be fruitful, is focusing on something together.
Because people join in, don't they? They join in because, like, we run a community farm in Waterloo. And people said to me, I remember saying, well, we can't take on running a community farm. We're already stretched. Whereas I think, no, if you take on running a community farm, there'd be tons of people who love the outdoors that become part of what you're doing are drawn into your orbit because you do it. Does that make sense? So the us gets bigger.
Big difference between something being biblical and being Christ-like. Slavery is biblical, but it isn't Christ-like. Sexuality is a bigger choice for me as the colour of my skin.
It's bigger.
It's not a choice.
It's not a choice.
Yes. Now that's interesting, because I understood what you said and it came out of my mouth completely differently. I think what you were trying to say was, I can't choose my sexuality. Right, we've got the message, haven't we? We can't tolerate racism in our churches, so why should we tolerate homophobic attitudes? Which I think is as much a statement as a question. And can we add transphobic to that? Are you happy to add that into your question? Of course you are.
I don't want to say much, except that when we say we can't tolerate racism in our churches, look around at this tent. We're white. I'm not. I'm a half-caste. You know? In other words, we have racism in our churches. And if I did not say that, my good friends, I think of my friend Ginny McDonald. Do you know Ginny? If Ginny was sat here, she'd find it so hard to hear that our churches are not racist. So do I, by the way. I'm normally written off as a white guy, which is how I get in.
I think Steve's right. The reality is we do tolerate racism within our churches. We do tolerate misogyny within our churches. I'm not saying it is right, but we do it because we're seeking to get somewhere. So I, as a female, have to tolerate the fact that I engage with people who don't believe I should have a voice. But I'm still there, not because I really want to irritate them, but because I believe that God's called me to those places. And sometimes that means I have to hear and face things that I really shouldn't. And in no other sphere of my life do I have to encounter them. If I was to go into a school, if I was to go into any other sphere of work, I would not be treated the same way as I am in the church that I love and the church I am called to. I don't think I tolerate it. I think I call it out. But it comes at a cost. But I think you're right. It's more hidden. So we know we can't say the racist things. We know we can't say the sexist things. But we can say the homophobic things. And I think that's part of us as a society growing up and understanding. So when I meet and talk to, and I don't mean to discriminate against them, but the white older man, and when I meet with people like that, they just don't understand. Because they've been brought up in a culture, they've been sat under a pulpit teaching where it is normative. So it's a re-education. Now, I'm not saying that to excuse, please don't hear me wrong, I'm not saying to excuse it, but I think we have to understand and try and all be on a journey to re-educate. I make mistakes all the time because of my own prejudice and my own unconscious bias, and quite frankly, my own bias that I'm very aware of. But I'm on a learning journey, And I think we do need in the church to call out the bad behaviour while walking with people who don't have the same behavioural expectations that we do.
Hayley, Kate, Claire, Steve, I've really enjoyed the last hour. I found it ever so helpful. Have you as well?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.